Cates, yes. Parshas Meat Cates is following our general pattern. We'll just learn a couple of psukim together, study some of the Chumash, get some fascinating insights as to what's going on. I'd like to start this fine afternoon, getting ready for Hanukkah, on page 232 and 233, the beginning of chapter 42. Sometimes I just open up the parsha, I just like blindly close my eyes and open up the page and say, we'll study this, because the truth is it's all good. It's all good, it's all rich, and it's all deep with insight. So it's just a matter we could study any number of verses and come up with mine beautiful pearls of wisdom. Okay, this particular story, which we will be studying this morning, the beginning of the story, we usually don't get very far, as I'm sure many of you have noticed, is really smack in the middle of this week's parsha. The parsha, of course, begins with Yosef's being incarcerated. He is in jail following his dreams of last week's parsha and the whole series of incidents which sent him down to Egypt. The wife of Potiphar has him arrested on false charges of trying to seduce her. And he ends up in jail, interprets the two chamberlains' dreams there, but is left there for an extra 2 years. Finally, in this week's parsha, gets brought out, interprets Paro's dreams successfully for him, is shown to be such a wise man that he's appointed the second in command of all of Egypt, successfully establishes a system of gathering the crops for the first 7 years of plenty, so that the land of Mitzrayim is prepared, and then we enter into the years of famine, and is within a very short period of time that the entire land of Egypt is entirely depleted of all of the good that they had during those first 7 years, and then we begin this process of all the nations of the world coming down to Egypt to go and buy food because there was nothing anywhere to be had. That's where our story picks up. So we're going to pick up with Yaakov and his sons back in the land of Canaan, our present-day Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. That's where Yaakov is with his sons, as they begin now this famous journey of the sons down to Mitzrayim, where we, of course, know what will eventually take place. The two meetings, first they'll meet without Binyamin, and then they'll meet with Binyamin, eventually leading to Yosef revealing himself. But we're at the point of the story where Yaakov is at home with his sons, as the famine has begun to take hold of the land of Canaan. So let's start studying together and see what we can learn. Says the Torah, says Hashem, beginning of chapter 42, Perek Mem Beis, Vayar Yaakov ki yesh shever b'mitzrayim. The word is Vayar, translated here as perceived, or to see, is the root of that word. Yaakov perceived, Yaakov saw, ki yesh shever b'mitzrayim, that there were provisions still in Mitzrayim. Vayomer Yaakov levanov, and Yaakov says to his sons, Loma tisra'u. Why, and here's a very difficult phrase which we will tackle in Rashi, you'll see article translates it as, why do you make yourselves conspicuous? Tisra'u. The root of that word tisra'u is again the same root from the first word of the chapter, vayar, to see. It's a derivation of that. You are being seen. You have been made conspicuous. So Yaakov asks to his sons, basically he says, he perceives, he sees that there is still food left in the land of Mitzrayim, in the land of Egypt. And he says to his sons, why are you making yourselves conspicuous? Now we're going to put that on hold, exactly what that means. Let's start with the first half of this verse. Now, it's a funny thing to say that Yaakov saw that there were provisions in Mitzrayim. What would be the more appropriate way to say that? He heard. He knew. One or the other, right? Either he knew, he had heard. Something would be a more appropriate way to describe Yaakov telling his children, hey, we're hungry, get some food down from the land of Egypt. I mean, he saw. He couldn't have possibly actually seen. I mean, he's hundreds of miles away. And in fact, if you look at the beginning of verse 2 says, Vayomer, and Yaakov continues saying to his sons, Hine shomati ki yeshever b'mitzrayim. When he actually speaks to his children, telling them to go down to the land of Egypt, he says, I have heard that there is food down in the land of Egypt. Go down there and get some. That sounds pretty appropriate. That's what a man should say to his sons. I've heard this land, there's food. Yet in these two consecutive verses, first the Torah says Yaakov saw that there was food in the land of Egypt, and then it turns around and he says, and I heard. Troubling, huh? Well, you're not the first ones to be troubled by it. The sages were bothered by what's the meaning of the vayar? Why does it say that Yaakov saw there was food down in the land of Mitzrayim? Sages say a very interesting thing. The first phrase, again, going back to verse 1, Pasuk Aleph, it says, how does the Torah describe there being food in the land of Egypt? With what Hebrew word do we describe that there is food in Mitzrayim? He uses the word shever. Shever. Kiyesh shever b'Mitzrayim, which is an interesting word. There are provisions. He doesn't say there is food in the land of Egypt. He doesn't say there is much. He uses the word shever. So the sages say, now you know in the Chumash, in the actual Torah, there are no vowels in the Chumash, which is where many of the drushas, many of the statements of the sages where they find various other hidden levels of understanding is from various ways to interpret the text. The word sever, with a sin, means hope. So the sages say, what Yaakov was almost unwittingly prophesizing about was Vayar Yaakov, and Yaakov saw that there was hope in the land of Mitzrayim. So the simple meaning is, and Yaakov saw there was food in the land of Egypt. But the sages are bothered by why would the Torah describe that by saying that he saw, when he means to say that he heard, which are the words that he actually uses himself in the following verse. So the sages say, Rashi quotes it here. I'll read the Rashi in text. The first Rashi, Meheichan ra, what does it mean he saw? Rashi asks, Halo lo ra, el ashama. Yaakov didn't hear or didn't see that there was food. He heard that there was food. So says Rashi, Mahu vaya, what does it mean to say that Yaakov saw? Ro'ah ba'aspaklaria shel kodesh, he saw, like in the vision of prophecy, sha'adayin yeshlo sever b'mitzrayim, that there was still hope. There was still hope. There was something going on down there in Egypt. V'lo haisa nevuah mamish, it was not a full prophecy to tell him that Yosef was still alive, but he had some form of a prophecy, understanding that there was something there in the land of Mitzrayim. And the sages are pointing out that the people we're talking about here, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, they're on levels that their regular speech was laced with hints of prophecy. They were connected to things in which the words they would say and the things they would choose to describe had hints of prophecy in them. He wasn't given a full vision to say, Yosef is still alive, I'm going to see my son again. But the way that the Torah describes Yaakov's awareness of the fact that there was food in Egypt was not simply by stating that he heard about it, but saying, I heard there is still hope, almost, to say, in the land of Mitzrayim, which of course would eventually materialize in Yosef. Okay, moving on. Lama tisro. So what does Yaakov say to his sons? Why should you be conspicuous? Why are you making yourselves conspicuous here? It's an interesting word. So Rashi describes the derivation of this word from the word ra'ah, to see. And Rashi said what Yaakov said to his sons are lama. I'm reading the second Rashi on the page. Lama tiru atzmachem bifnei bnei Yishmael ubnei Esav sveim. Why are you appearing before the children of Esav and the children of Yishmael as if you are still satiated? Why are you appearing? Your being here are giving the appearance that we still have lots of food. Everybody around us is hungry. They're going down to Egypt to buy something. And you're just staying here. Your presence here is an indication of wealth, an indication of prosperity, an indication of being totally satiated with food. Says Rashi, why are you giving that appearance to everybody around you, to the Bnei Esav and to the Bnei Yishmael, the children of Esav and the children of Yishmael, that you still have much? They had, it was true that the children of Yaakov had, but if you guys stay here when everybody else is packing up and heading down south, what's everyone going to say? What's everyone going to know? We got all the goods. We don't want that, says Yaakov. Don't want it to be a situation where everybody knows that we got all the money. We got all of the tevua, we have all of the produce, we're not hungry, everybody else is hungry. So says Yaakov to his sons, you need to go down to Mitzrayim to go buy food, and this interpretation, just in order to make sure that we don't give that appearance that we still have when nobody else has.
How is it that he had... their family had all the...
I would imagine the simple answer to that is simply the divine... Hashem had it worked out. They weren't depleted, their crops grew, whatever it would be that it would produce. That's what I would imagine. The simple, I don't have a definitive source to point to tell you that, but that's what it would seem to me. Now the Ramban asks a very interesting question on this Rashi. Who did Rashi say that Yaakov was afraid of? Which people? Which two specific people? Esav and Yishmael. Those are the specific people that Rashi quotes as Yaakov saying to his sons, don't appear before the children of Esav and Yishmael as having a lot of stuff. Says the Ramban, where is Yaakov and his children living right now? Where are they?
Yeah. They're in Canaan.
They're in Canaan, the land of Canaan. That's not where the Bnei Esav and the Bnei Yishmael live. They lived in other areas. What should have Yaakov should have said is, being afraid of our neighbors, the children of Canaan, the 31 kingdoms that are currently dwelling right in our midst, they're the people that we should be afraid of. Why do we want to appear into all of our neighbors, the Am Ha'aret, the people living in the land, as having much? Why does Rashi specifically single out and say, we don't want to look like we have a lot of stuff in front of the children of Esav? They don't even live in the area. So Ravan says an interesting thing. Ravan says, well, nobody had any food. Where is the food?
Egypt.
How do you get to Egypt? You got to go through the land of Israel, the way that it's situated. All those lands around Israel at the time, the land of Canaan, you were going to be traveling through. So the Ramban says, it must be that what Yaakov was afraid of is as the children of Esav and Yishmael will pass through, they're going to see how much you have. That's the first comment the Ramban makes. Says the Maharal, okay, still, but that doesn't make them any different than the neighbors that are living there right now. Why? Okay, so not only do I have 31 kingdoms living around me right now, I also have the Bnei Yishmael and the Bnei Esav, the children of Esav and Yishmael passing through. Why is that more of a fear? Says the Maharal, amazing thing. The Maharal says, because there's a requirement in the laws of charity to take care of your family first. V'chai achicha imach. You must give your brother literally to live first. And when it comes to tzedakah, there is a hierarchy of needs. There's a hierarchy that says, first you give to your own, and then you start giving to your city, and then you give to your country, and then you give to Israel. There's a whole hierarchy of how it works. But your flesh and blood, they have precedence. Says the Maharal, Yaakov was afraid, yeah, the other eight, we can avoid them. We're not afraid they're going to take our stuff, or it's going to be bad, because this is we're taking care of our own. Everybody knows we need our own food. But when the Bnei Esav and the Bnei Yishmael come through, and they're going to see that we still have all the goods, they're going to have a right to say, we're taking it. I want them. We're hungry. And so Yaakov says, then that's going to cause trouble. Because what's going to happen is either we're going to get into a big fight, or we have nothing left. So Yaakov says to his sons, and the Ramal is pointing out specifically why Rashi says the children of Esav and Yishmael. So Yaakov says, listen, don't appear like we have much in front of the children of Esav and Yishmael, because when they pass by and they see that we're just hanging out, then obviously we got food, so they're going to say, well then why are we schlepping all the way down to Mitzrayim? Our cousins have right here. Esav and Yishmael are both cousins of the Jewish people. They're going to stop right there, and either there's going to be a clash, or they're going to take everything of ours, and then we're going to die because we're going to have no food. So it says, Yaakov, go down now already. Go down to the shrine, get some food. You got to be like everybody else and make sure that we have enough to provide for our families. Very interesting. Very interesting shot. That's what Rashi says, based on the sages in this verse of Lo Matis Ro'u, why are you appearing? Why should you make yourself conspicuous? Why should you make it obvious that you have so much food by not going down? And this has been... this sort of argument has been throughout our history. It's a Jewish cultural thing. It should be a Jewish cultural thing, which unfortunately, as our years in America have gone on, we've lost. But that sense of not making it appear that we have much. Not making it appear that we are the wealthy ones, that we have produce, that we have the tefuah. That's always been a Jewish trait of, if I got it, that's fine. But it doesn't need to be that all the nations of the world around me know about it. It doesn't have to be that way. It's always been derived from this statement that Yaakov makes to his children. You act like everybody else. They're going down to Mitzrayim to get food. We have. You go down and get food. Either because they're going to take it or we just don't want the neighbors. It's an approach that says if God has blessed us, we don't have to be the source of envy of all the nations of the world. As far as that. We mentioned many times here I'm not sure if this story ever actually happened, but it could have happened. So it's, as Rabbi Barrel Wine likes to say, it doesn't matter. And it tells you the historical context regardless of the Hasidic Jew who got onto a bus in New York somewhere and ends up sitting down next to somebody, and the person starts berating him. Why do you have to dress so funny? Why don't you shave your beard and your clothing? Why can't you be like the rest of us? So the Jew turns to him and says, I'm sorry, I'm not a Hasidic Jew, I'm one of the Amish. So the guy says, oh, I'm sorry, absolutely, it's okay, it's value, it's so nice what you're doing, and it's just great. So he says, why is that? I'm not sure if that ever really happened, but we could hear that would happen. And why is that? Because the Amish say, I'm not living in the world like you. I don't have your fancy cars. I don't have your house. I don't have the jewelry. I don't have the chandeliers. I'm living in a horse and buggy in the middle of Pennsylvania. I'm not bothering you. All right, you want to live like that? I can respect that. Do whatever you want. But to live as my neighbor and drive a nicer car than me and have a nicer house than me and take off on Shabbos and Yom Tov and Pesach and this and that and say that you're holier than me, that's offensive. That doesn't go so well amongst our neighbors. And there's always been, well, you don't have to show that off if you've been given blessings. It's very nice you've been given blessings, but there's no need that everybody has to know that. Loma Tisro, why do you have to make yourself conspicuous, especially if everybody's wealthy, it's one thing. But when you're in times of famine and people don't have, that's when it's very difficult. I was just reading yesterday, there's a book called Postville. You know, there's about the slaughterhouse in Iowa. So I was just reading, I was in the library the other day, and that was the book that I was reading through it. And that's what it was. It was a culture. It was all of a sudden a poor, run-down little shabby town of 1,000 people. And all of a sudden, you know, the Jews come in. They make this huge slaughterhouse, one of the largest in the world. Money is pouring in. And you're very conspicuous. You're not just hiding amongst the people. You're out there. And the whole book just described the culture clash about that whole scene. In any case, that's what Yaakov says to his sons. Okay. Pasuk Beis, moving on. Vayomer. So again, reading Pasuk 2, verse 2. Vahine shomati. So Yaakov says to his sons, I have heard ki yesh shever b'Mitzrayim. I've heard there are provisions down in Mitzrayim, in Egypt. Redu shoma. Go down. Redu is from the word vayered. We had that word twice last week, if you remember. Vayered Yehuda me'eis echav. Yehuda went down from his brothers. We described last week how his stature went down. He was demoted, so to speak, in the eyes of his brothers because he had the opportunity to tell them to save Yosef, and he didn't. So they sort of, you know, he lost stature in his eyes. And he had that same word, Vayered Yosef Mitzrayim. Yosef went down to Mitzrayim. So Yaakov again uses that same word to his brothers, Redu Shama, go down to Egypt and get for us food, V'nichya V'lo Namos, that we should live and not die. Now the sages are bothered here by the fact that Yaakov chose that word, Redu. Redu has that negative connotation. It has a connotation of a demotion, a going down in stature. And even though, technically speaking, you're physically going down, Eretz Yisrael is the highest of all lands, so to go to Mitzrayim, you are physically descending, says the Maral, it's not the way to talk. You don't say to somebody, Redu. It's a language that says, you've lost your stature. When the Jewish people sin at the golden calf, so where's Moshe at the time? He's getting the Torah. What does Hashem say to him? Lech raid. Lech, go, raid, from the same root, redu, go down. You can't be here anymore. If your people have fallen from their level, you are their leader, you go with them. If they're not on a level that you can be up here, even though you haven't fallen, but you're no longer representing a people that entitles you to be here, so go down. That same word, redu, it implies a physical going down, and it has a connotation of diminished stature as well. So the sages are bothered. Why did Yaakov say that to his sons? Why did he use that word when he told them to go down to Mitzrayim? Why did he use a word which has so many other connotations instead of just saying, you know, Lech l'Mitzrayim, go down to Mitzrayim? So the sages say this is another example where Yaakov was prophesizing without knowing it. What is the numerical equivalency of the word Redu? Resh is 200. Dalet is 4. And Vav? 6. Gives you a grand total of?
26?
14? 200. Rashi's 200. 4 and 6. 210. How many years were the Jewish people down in Egypt? 210. So the sages, with prophesizing without knowing, Yaakov chose a word which hints at the fact when he says to his sons, go down to Egypt. That's what he's telling them, right? He's telling them, he thinks he's telling them, just go down and get us some food. But on a cosmic level, what is he telling them? Go down to Egypt. How long are you going to be down there? 210 years until we're ready to come out. Say the sages, and the words that he chose to describe that descent down to Egypt is a word which specifically has that same numerical equivalency of the 210 years that they would be there, and therefore he specifically uses the word redu, not knowingly, again, unwittingly saying, you need to be there for 210 years, you'll go down there. Interesting, huh? Okay, moving forward. One second. Okay. Moving forward. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Vayerdu achei Yosef asara lishbor bor Mitzrayim. The sons, the brothers of Yosef, 10 of them, went down to buy grain from Egypt. Two problems in this verse. What are the two problems?
Yosef had 11 brothers.
Excellent. Okay, number one. Well, to take off on that. How many brothers does Yosef have? We know he has 11 brothers, right? Mm-hmm. So let's just read one more verse. Let's read verse 4 together to get the full effect of the question on from the third pasuk here. That's Binyamin achi Yosef lo shaloch Yaakov es echad. Binyamin, Yosef's brother, was not sent by Yaakov down to Mitzrayim, ki Omar pen yikur enu asom, because Yaakov was afraid lest anything befall him. Let me read one more. We'll go back over all these. Vayavo b'nei Yisrael lishvor b'soy chaboim. And then the children of Yisrael, the b'nei Yisrael, came to get food amongst those who came down. Okay, that's the background. Let's go back to verse 3 for a second. The brothers of Yosef, who were 10, came down to get buy grain from Egypt. So the two problems here. It's a little tricky, but if you pay attention to verses 4 and 5, you can come up with some nuances of language that should jump out at you. I'll give you a hint. How do we describe these 10 men going down? With what language, what descriptive words do we use in verse 3 as opposed to, say, verse 5?
Yosef's brothers, and in verse 5 it's the sons of Israel.
Good. We change how we describe them. In verse 3, they are called the Achei Yosef. Who went down to Egypt? The Achei Yosef. The brothers of Yosef went down. We don't call them the sons of Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, the way we call them in verse 5, as we normally call them. What are we called? The B'nai Yisrael. Why are we called B'nai Yisrael? Because B'nai means sons of, and Yisrael is a reference to Yaakov. So we are the B'nai Yisrael. That's how the brothers are described in verse 5. The sons of Israel came to get food. Yet in verse 3, how are they defined?
Brothers of Yosef.
Interesting. That's question number 1. Question number 2. The mathematicians out there, let's see if we can follow this. Ready? Difficult math. How many brothers are there? Good. How many do not go down?
One.
How do you know that?
Because 10 went, and Yosef was one, and verse 1.
Okay, you even said additional pieces. What does it say in verse 4? Who didn't go?
Benjamin.
That's explicit, right? So the mathematicians amongst us can say, well, we know that there are a total of 12. We know that. I know Yosef's already in Mitzrayim, right? The verse says Binyamin didn't go because he wasn't sent by Yaakov. How many are left?
10.
So we could have figured that out on our own, right? We could have taken out our calculators and said, well, 12. 12 minus 1, Yosef, he's not there, is 11. Binyamin didn't go because he's staying behind. How many brothers went down to Egypt?
10.
If I wouldn't have told you that in verse 3, and I asked you, how many brothers went down to Egypt, what would you have told me? It would have been pretty easy, right? You would have said 10, because Yosef's already there, and Binyamin wasn't sent. It says explicitly in the next pasuk, why does it need to say, Vayerdu achei Yosef asara? The brothers of Yosef went down, there were 10 of them. Thank you very much. Now I don't have to deal with the mental gymnastics of figuring out that if I started with 12, and I don't take 2, they're 10. I know that. Why does the Torah need to tell me, specifically, that there were 10 of them? Was it necessary?
Maybe because Binyamin and Joseph was from the same mother.
Okay, yeah.
So, like the other the 10 were from other mothers.
Okay. I hear that. An interesting suggestion. Remind you what the sages have to say?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so Rashi says this fast. Do you hear the questions? Yeah? Did you notice that Rabbi Katz does that? Did anyone hear him speak over Shabbos?
Yes.
So he very often says, do we hear the problem? And if he doesn't get an adequate response, is anybody there? Are you with me? It's constantly feeling and making sure that on some level, even simply a response of yes, mentally for the listener, you know, keeps you engaged. It keeps you a part of that. Over and over, he was right. If you heard him speak more than once or twice, you couldn't help but notice that pattern of, are you with me? Everybody, anybody out there, somebody, respond to me.
Yeah.
That's why it's so hard to speak on the phone if the person doesn't say, uh-huh. You can't keep talking if you don't know that somebody is responding to you. And that's why, as I've mentioned many times, that's why it's so hard to daven. Because there's nobody on the other end of the line responding. There is somebody on the other end of the line. There's nobody on the other end of the line responding with those verbal or physical cues that we use to know that we're communicating. I mean, it's so hard to communicate with somebody if you don't get that feedback, that response. So just like we have trouble talking on the phone without it, we have trouble davening, and as a speaker, constantly, so you with me? Well, we hear the question, and I'm just a little tangential there. Right? We hear the question. So the sages say as follows. Pasuk Gimel, Rashi, in the bottom of the first column, Vayerdu Achei Yosef. So the first issue that Rashi tackles is, why do we define the brothers as brothers of Yosef? They're almost never defined that way. They're always defined as, from the relation is in relation to their father, Yaakov. They are the children of Yaakov. They're not defined as the brothers of Yosef. Says Rashi, V'loksiv b'nei Yaakov. They're not called here going down as brothers of Yaakov. Milamed, you want to know what this is coming to teach us, says Rashi, based on the sages. Shehoyu mischarotin b'mechiroso. They had charata. They had remorse. They had remorse over the fact that they sold him. And they went down to Egypt as brothers of Yosef. Not as children of Yaakov. They went down to Egypt as brothers of Yosef. Nosnu libom, Rashi says, they paid attention and put in their hearts lehisnaheg imo ve'achva, to deal with him, treat him as a brother. V'liftoso b'chol mamon sheyisaku aleihem, and to redeem him with whatever cost, whatever amount of ransom was asked. That's the mindset that the brothers went down with. So what's the Torah hinting at by defining the brothers not from the focal point of their father Yaakov, but from the focal point of Yosef, saying they went down as brothers of Yosef? They went down as brothers of Yosef, remorseful over the sale of Yosef, contrite, filled with the resolve that we will redeem him as our brother for whatever it will cost, we will do. Now, hold that thought, because you're going to find it. The next Rashi is going to be really interesting. What was the second problem with this verse? A, they were defined as brothers of Yosef. Okay, so I know that. The reason why the focal point of their description is because they're brothers of Yosef, to teach us they were now whole with him as a brother, ready to redeem him. But then we said there were 10 of them. Totally unnecessary. We know how many they were. So if the verse would have just left it blank, that the brothers of Yosef went down, I would have known that they were 10 of them, and that would have been an irrelevant piece of information. Now that you're stressing that they were 10, you're clearly distinguishing 10 different individuals going. Because I don't need this number. The number is irrelevant, right? That's what I was setting up before. So if you tell me an irrelevant number, you're clearly making irrelevant that there were 10 disparate, distinct units going down, and you need to know that. What was so different and unique about them that I need to know about these brothers of Yosef who have decided to redeem him? Says Rashi, Ma Talmud Lomer, why do I need to know there were 10? Ela le'inyan ha'achva, within this issue of feeling the brotherhood, within this resolve that they have, we regret that which we did. We are remorseful and we're going to buy him back. Hoyu chalukin la'asor. They were still 10 different individuals with that resolve. Says Rashi, an amazing thing. I don't remember until I just prepared for this class. Ever seen some Rashi's like skipped through. I don't remember ever seeing this Rashi before. Says Rashi, Shelo hayasa ahavas kulam v'sinas kulam shavalo. They were not equal in their level of love and hatred for him. They were different. Each one had a different relationship with him, a different level of bond, a different level of either the love or the hatred that they had had previously in wanting to have sold him. And therefore, they're all going down now in distinct ways. 10 people all going with the same mission, regretful and remorseful, we're going to buy him back. Yet, 10 individuals doing that in their own way, on their own level, with their own feelings, with their own level of love or hatred, differently, all going down, but remorseful nonetheless, to go buy him back. Fascinating. I mean, it's so true whenever you have a situation like that. We agree as a group to do this. We made a decision as a group. We're going to decide. We're canceling class next Tuesday. Made a decision. And then we regret it. So we all get together and we say, that was wrong of us, because it's really, it's a fantastic class, and why should we do something like that? So we all regret it. We're all remorseful. Yet each individual amongst us had a different calculation as to why either we should have or we shouldn't have. And so as a group, as a whole, we're one. Sometimes we're all together, and often we're not. Often we are a whole bunch of individuals making the same conclusion, coming to the same decision, but from very different places. That we were all different. Shelo haisa ahavas kulam v'sinas kulam shavalo. The love or the hate that they had for him was not equivalent. It was not the same. But regarding buying the food, they were all the same. That, for sure, they were all the same. They all went down together to buy food, but they were 10 different brothers, all agreeing, being remorseful to redeem him, with different levels in their relationship towards him. Okay, that's what the sages have to say on that verse. So the brothers of Yosef went down to buy food, and there were 10 of them who went down.
Rabbi,
yeah?
How did they know that Yosef was still alive?
They didn't. They did. That's what 100%. They knew that he had been sold down there. That they seemed to have understood that he was down there. And they went down then. We were going to try to find him. It was definitely possible that he wasn't alive. If they knew somehow. I don't know whether or not they had some sort of just...
It doesn't explain it.
Yeah, no. That I don't know. It seemed that they sensed on some level that he was still alive.
The guilt,
but
the guilt was enough.
Maybe it was what we mentioned before. Remember I mentioned last week or 2 weeks ago that Yaakov mourned for Yosef 22 years each day as if it was the day that he found out about his death. Refusing to be comforted, it was just too painful. So it could be that they saw that and they said, can't be that he actually died. Had he died, Dad wouldn't be going through this. So maybe they sensed almost through that that the level of pain was such that maybe they knew he was still alive. I don't know exactly. Yeah.
I always wondered about that. Why didn't Joseph, with all his, he was such an important man, why couldn't he send a little note to Dad?
Okay, so the Ramban, well, hopefully we'll get to that. The Ramban asks that question. Nachman, he has a lengthy piece in this week's Parsha discussing that question, in which he says, if I can't come up with a good answer to that question, says the Ramban, then it would be considered a sin of enormous proportions that Yosef would allow his father to suffer so and not have sent him word. So I better have a good answer. And he does come up with his answer. We'll hopefully get to that. We're working towards that. Anyway, verse 4. So Binyamin is not sent down. Why does Yaakov not send Binyamin down to Mitzrayim? Ki Omar, for Yaakov said to himself, lest disaster befall him. I'm afraid, who knows what will happen? Says Rashi. I mean, we all intuit this. What are we afraid of? Afraid of being struck by lightning? Afraid of being attacked? If a disaster is going to happen, we all believe in some form of divine providence. I mean, we, the lowly little us, who are living in, we believe on some level of divine providence. We live with that. Yaakov Avinu? Yaakov is saying, oh, I can't send Binyamin. Something might happen to him. Says Rashi, and something's not going to happen to him at home? Something was supposed to happen to him. Something's going to happen to him. If nothing's going to happen to him, nothing's going to happen to him. What difference does it make where he is? Don't you believe in some divine... It's like not just random. Who cares if he's on the road or if he's at home? Rashi says an amazing thing. Says Rashi, and in the home, disaster won't strike. Amar Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, Mikan shehasatan mekatreg b'shas hasakana. From here you learn, from Yaakov's response, you learn that the Satan, the prosecuting angel, so to speak, has an opening to lay his case in front of Hashem during times of danger. When danger lurks, and you put yourself in a dangerous place, you open yourself up for those things that you've done wrong, where the Satan can bring that, so to speak, before God and say, remember what he did last week? Remember what he did last year? I'll just remember that. And when you're in a dangerous place already, you're open to that. You're more susceptible to that. When life is normal, and it would have to be something unusual to happen to you, so then we're dealt with, these are the normal guidelines of divine providence, and we're judged accordingly, and we're given a lot of mercy and rachmanos and lengthiness of response time that God gives us to remedy our ways. And therefore, the things that we did wrong aren't, so to speak, brought before Him. When you step out into a dangerous place, into a dangerous situation, what you've done is you've made it really easy, so to speak, for the Satan to say, well, what about all these other things that he's done? You don't need something abnormal to come, a lightning bolt to strike his house. He's standing on the edge of a cliff going bungee jumping. And remember all those things that he did? You've opened yourself up to disaster. It's a fascinating insight into the workings of the divine providence that says when you put yourself out there, and you're deserving of it, it's not that it's undeserved, but that normally God would give you time, He would allow for this, He would allow for that, but when you're out there in a dangerous situation, so then the Satan, this prosecuting angel, so to speak, can put his case before God, and you're already like teetering on the way, you're already in a dangerous place. It's like so easy, so to speak, without any abnormal event, without any miraculous events, for something to happen to you. Yaakov teaches us, I can't send him down to Mitzrayim, it's a dangerous trip. And to put him in a place of danger opens him up to what we call Misa Bidei Shamayim, a heavenly retribution, a heavenly death sentence that's not carried out by a basin, it's just things happen. When do those things happen? When are you opened up for that? By putting yourself in a dangerous place. So Yaakov says, sure, I believe in divine providence. And if something was going to happen, it would happen anywhere. But it's for something that wouldn't otherwise have happened, but if I put him out in a dangerous place, it might happen. That's what I'm protecting him from.
What did Benjamin do to create
that? That's what Yaakov's saying. I don't know. Oh. That was Yaakov's fear. Yaakov, in other words, that's a fair question. Yaakov's love of Binyamin was such that said, I don't know what's going on in his heart of hearts. I don't know where he stands in his service of Hashem. All I know is that I'm not putting him out in a dangerous place. We all know that on the levels of the Avos, of the fathers, and of the Shvatim, of these 12 tribes, they're on levels well beyond what we're holding. And that which to us would seem like minor deviances from the straight and narrow was for them much greater. So Yaakov said, I don't know what he's done. I don't know. But I'm not putting him out there in a dangerous place. It's a tremendous, lesson in terms of where we go and what we do. Yeah, you need to be careful when you say you're going to the. You got to be careful when you go in dangerous places because you've opened yourself up, so to speak, to that prosecuting angel. When you do this, and that's what Yaakov teaches us when he says, "I don't want to send Binyamin lest something befall him." All right, shall we move on? Verse 5, Pasuk Hei, Vayavo'u b'nei Yisrael l'shpor b'soich haboyim. So the children of Israel, they came to buy provisions amongst all of the, all of those who came to the land of Egypt. Ki hayo ha'ra'ov y'eretz Canaan, because there was a famine in the land of Canaan, even though they had technically had food, Yaakov sends them down, and now they've gotten there amongst all those others who have come, to come. So Rashi points out that they hid themselves. The phrase amongst all the others who are coming means they literally were amongst them. Like one was here, one was there. They were disguised and didn't come as a big caravan of 10 spiritual giants. They went all over the place. Rashi points out that their father had commanded them not to appear all together walking in as one, but in order that the Ayin Hara should not be sholeit on them, that the evil eyes, so to speak, the people should look at them and see all of these 10 handsome, strong, spiritual giants all coming in together, and again, everybody would be looking at them. And as the Ayin, we're not getting into a shmooze on what Ayin Hara is, but it's certainly something within. It's a real idea. It's not just one of those Bubba mices. You don't want people to see your things, like we were speaking about before. Don't be conspicuous. It's such a concept. Whatever that means, we'll talk about maybe some other time. But Yaakov says to them, don't draw attention. I don't want everybody looking at you and saying, wow, what a family. Look at those 10 sons. Big guys, strong, good-looking men. They're obviously there with their spiritual prowess. So don't do that. So they went in amongst the people, separated one this gate, one through that gate. Yosef hayo hashalit al haaretz, pasuk svav, verse 6. Yosef was the ruler on the land. Hu hamashpir l'cholam haaretz. He was the provider to all the people. So the brothers come and they bow down before him. Now we know that that is extremely significant. Why is it so significant to describe to us that the brothers come and bow down before Yosef?
They didn't know he was Yosef.
They didn't know, but this is his dreams, right? His dreams were, they're going to be bundles of wheat or stars bowing down to me. So here you have the brothers showing up, and they bow down to Yosef. Zion 7. Vayar Yosef esechov vayakireim. Yosef sees his brothers, and he recognizes them. Now the Torah has an interesting word following this. Vayisnaker aleihem. So the article is going to take one of Rashi's translations, but the word is an interesting, has a root, vayisnaker aleihem. So the first translation that Rashi gives is the one that Art Scroll says. He acted like a stranger. The word nochri is similar to the word vayaker, which means to recognize. Hakarat hatov means to recognize the good that's been done for you. Nochri is a related word, but unrelated in meaning, shares the nun and the chaf is its roots, but it means a stranger. So Rashi's first interpretation, which is what Art Scroll here translates this as, is that the brothers, Yosef saw the brothers, he recognized them, but acted like a stranger towards them, speaking harshly, saying to them, where are you from? Why are you here? To which they say, we're here from the land of Canaan, and we want to buy provisions. The Ramban adds two interpretations here. The Ramban says, number one, Yosef Vayakirem recognized them. Vayisnaker aleihem means he made himself like a stranger, not just by speaking harshly, but by physically disguising himself. He made it more difficult. He pulled the veil over himself, or he pulled his hat down low. That's one interpretation he gives. And then the second thing he says is he recognized them through speaking harshly to them. Meaning when he said to them, why are you guys here and what are you doing here? And they said, oh, we're from the land of Canaan. We've come to buy food. He was confirming that this was in fact his brothers from the land of Canaan and not someone else. So by speaking harshly to them, that helped him recognize them. Okay, in any case, last couple things I want to speak of before we run out of time. Vayakir Yosef es echo v'hem lo hikiruhu. Verse 8. So again, the Torah describes Yosef recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Why is that? So Rashi says, he left them bearded. The brothers were older than him. They already had their beard all grown in. So he recognized them. They looked pretty much the same as they had when he left them 22 years before. But they didn't recognize him. Because he did not have a beard when he left. He was only 17 years old. Now he's got a beard. It's 22 years later. He's an older man. That's Rashi quotes from the same of Chazal. The Maral talks about how the sages knew that was the issue at hand. I want to share with you a Ramban, a beautiful, beautiful Ramban. The Ramban asks, wait one minute. There is not a lot of time between Yosef and his next older brother. How many years? Okay, maybe between the oldest brother, Reuven, and Yosef, was 10 years, 12 years, whatever it was. So you want to say when Yosef was 17, he was already a grown man, he was in his 30s. But all of the other brothers number 7, 8, 9, and 10 before Yosef, were not more than 3 or 4 years older than him. So there's such a difference, says the Ramban, that Yosef didn't have the beard, so they couldn't recognize him, and he recognized them. Ramban says two beautiful ideas. He says, A, the eldest brothers, Yosef was able to recognize easily. Because the younger brothers also changed a lot. They grew from young men of 21, 22 to men of in their 40s. But the oldest brothers, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, they went from the ages of, say, you know, 30 to 50. That's much easier to recognize. Says Ramban, from the recognition of the older brothers, once he recognized the older brothers, then he was able to recognize easily the younger brothers. But the brothers recognizing Yosef, who didn't have a context. As if I know, if I'm looking at three people, and one I know, because I recognize him, he was a good friend of mine, but the other two were his younger brothers, who I wouldn't have recognized if I passed on the street, but when I see you standing next to them, and I know you, oh yeah, sure, you're the younger brother. That's the first thing the Ramban says. So that Yosef was able to recognize, they all changed over 22 years. But because he was able to easily recognize the oldest brothers, they hadn't changed as much, he was able to recognize the younger brothers, even though they also didn't have a beard when he left them, and then they grew one. But if the context, he was able to recognize them, whereas they had no context, couldn't recognize them. Fine, that's answer number one. Then the Ramban says a beautiful insight. He says, also, Yosef was looking for them. Yosef was waiting for the brothers to come. He knew there was a famine everywhere, and he knew he had dreams to fulfill. He's been waiting 22 long years to fulfill these dreams, having his brothers bow down to him. He didn't know why it had to happen, and he didn't know how it was going to happen, but he had had a prophecy. Brothers were coming to bow, and look at it, I'm now the king of Egypt. I'm the second in command. Things are falling into place. When are they going to come? Everyone who comes into my chamber bows down to me. It's going to happen. He's waiting. He's waiting. And when you're waiting for something, he saw them and he recognized them because he was on the lookout. Couldn't wait to see those brothers. Couldn't wait for history to play itself out. The brothers, on the other hand, says the Ramban, the last place in the world that they're looking for Yosef is on the throne. Says them about such an insight. When you're expecting something and you're looking for something, you can recognize it. If you're not looking for it and you're not expecting it, it could be staring you in the face, you'll never see it. So that a little change, yeah, the beard. Was it right? Was it the same face they had recognized? No, it was a little different. Was Yosef able to recognize his brothers? Sure, but it was different. Of course it was different. But if you're looking, you'll see through that. If you're not expecting and you're not looking, it'll throw you off. It's a magnificent insight because it applies in so many things in life, what we're looking for. When you're looking for things, you see it all over the place. You know, you're looking to buy a new car, that's all that you see on the roads are the cars you're thinking about, the cars you're not thinking about, the colors, you see it all. When you're not looking to buy a car, you wouldn't have a clue if I asked you how many cameras did you pass on your way up. No idea. If you're looking in the market, the minor car, you can tell exactly how many are. Everybody's got one. It's like that with everything. Looking to find whatever it is that you're looking for, whatever you're interested in, whatever you're pursuing, you just see it. And you'll see through shades that are difficult to pick through, but you can pick through it. And that's one of the things in terms of what are you looking for? And it applies in the world, in the spiritual world as well. What are we looking for? Are we looking for when we go through life? This is an example. Are you looking for a bargain? Or are you looking for something to grow? When you walk through the mall, the things that you'll see, and all through life, what's on our mind that we're looking for? If what's on our mind is the best bargain out there, so we'll notice all the signs with the sale, that's what we're looking for. And sometimes that's what we need to be doing, that's why we're there. But as we go through life, if we're looking for lessons, people are like, how do you have so many stories? If you go through life and you're living it, you're paying attention, everything that takes place is a story. There's something to be learned. There's an interaction you had with somebody that has some meaning, some value, something that you can take out of, you can apply, or you pick up on some need that they have that you can help out. Everything is there. But if you're not looking for it, these things smack you in the face and you missed it because it wasn't like written down. Here's an inspirational story. And if it's not written and provided you that heading, you don't have it. If you're looking for inspiration, you'll find it. Because it's there. The interactions that you have are all laced with things that you can take and learn from. But we're not looking for it, because we're so busy with our primary task, which is I need to buy a new coat. So I'm looking to see where the greatest sale is. So I walk right past something which could have had tremendous value for me, but I'm busy with something else. I didn't notice it. But this Ramban is so insightful. It's such a magnificent Ramban that the brothers didn't notice Yosef because they weren't expecting to see him. They couldn't imagine that he would be here, so they didn't see him. Standing in the face, they didn't see him. Yosef, who had his eyes out for them, he found what he was looking for. It's such a great, great little lesson. And it's so, so many things. All right. The Ramban, we're going to run out of time for this Ramban. Your question is why. Yosef didn't send word back to his father for this reason, that he was waiting for the dreams to be fulfilled. He needed the 11 brothers to bow down. Well, it's a longer discussion that's worthy of almost a whole hour to work through the Ramban. He goes through so many different points of the story. But in a word, once you raise the question, the Ramban takes that idea, this waiting of the fulfillment of the dream, and said, this has to play itself out. If I send word back to my father that I'm alive, it's not going to happen. And it needs to happen in this way, and therefore he went through this whole process in which he gets Binyamin to come down, and then he tests the brothers to make sure that they're really real about it. That's his approach, which again is a much longer discussion. Maybe in another year we will go through that Ramban. But that is his approach. But that's some thoughts on this coming parsha. Have a wonderful Chanukah, a meaningful Chanukah. Look for the lights, the meaning of the lights, as you go through. And Mirat Hashem, we'll see you next week.
Thank you.